This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Now, I never believed that any war is about religion. War is economics, is about money, is about somebody getting paid.
That's terrorism analyst Victor Gomaswana on how much influence religion plays in Mozambique's insurgency. Details coming up also. Gunmen in Nigeria's northwest kidnap 9 students on their way back home from school. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The Southern Africa Development Community, or SADC Bloc of States, says it is confident that its troops will help to end an insurgency in northern Mozambique. Yesterday, at a summit of SADC heads of state in Lilongwe, Malawi, a communique from the meeting commended the countries that have sent troops to confront extremists in Cabo Delgado province. Insurgents calling themselves Al-Shabaab began occupying the region in late 2017. Since then, they've killed an estimated 3,000 people, and their attacks on villages and towns have displaced hundreds of thousands. Darren Taylor reports.
Professor Adriano Nuvunga of the Center for Democracy and Development in Maputo says it's great to see SADC finally giving serious attention to the situation in Cabo Delgado.
The joint forces have been successful thus far, so it is indeed a commendable operation. There are challenges, of course, in terms of coordination, in terms of adherence to the international humanitarian law and relationship with the communities.
For him, one of the most important developments emanating from the SADC meeting is Tanzania's offer to host a regional terrorism operations center. Although that country's in East Africa, it's also a member of SADC and shares an extensive border with Mozambique.
Until recently, Tanzania was failing to participate in some of the very important platforms that SADC has been organizing. But also there are issues, cross-border issues with Mozambique, with some of the people seeking refugee in Tanzania being returned. So it's important to see that Tanzania is not only stepping up to support Mozambique directly, but it's offering to harbor such a center, which is vital for the future.
Nuvunga says the Tanzanian government's obviously concerned, and rightly so, that the terrorists in Cabo Delgado are also active in East Africa. Rwanda, a non-SADC state, shares the same concerns, says terrorism analyst Victor Gomaswana.
Mozambique shares a border with Tanzania. Tanzania shares a border with Rwanda. So what happens in Cabo Delgado can spill over to Rwanda. But I like the fact that a non-SADC member jumped the start and sent troops, 1,000 troops. So already 35% or so of the required force was supplied by Rwanda, which should have been an embarrassment for SADC.
Gomaswana says when it comes to combating terrorism and dealing with problems in general, SADC is always very slow to act when compared with other regional blocs on the continent.
We like to workshopping, holding sessions, calling each other your excellencies, this, your excellency, that. When the insurgents are killing people, they are disrupting investments, they are destroying infrastructure that's been put up there in the name of goodness knows what.
But, says the analyst, the time for talking is over. Now it's time to stop terrorists who seem to be acting more and more like Al-Shabaab in Somalia and extremists in the Middle East by beheading people and committing other atrocities.
They say the way Islam is practiced in Mozambique is feared from the teachings of Prophet Muhammad. Now, I never believed that any war is about religion. War is economics, is about money, is about somebody getting paid, is about somebody disrupting another's economic plans.
At this stage, says Gomaswana, it's the Rwandese soldiers who seem to be the most proactive, already engaging in several firefights with the insurgents. If South Africa, he says, can back up its claim to be one of the continent's military powerhouses, the terrorists will be in real trouble. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
After initially being under siege since November, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, managed to break a blockade and push back on Amhara and Ethiopian National Defense Forces, a pact between the TPLF and the Oromo Liberation Army. OLA in the south was announced. Some analysts argue it is like a counter-strategy against the new National Front that Prime Minister Abiy forged to isolate the TPLF. OLA may not be as strong militarily as the TPLF, but the size of the ethnicity gives cause for TPLF to accept the alliance. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Well, it's a very significant development and represents an escalation of the conflict. You know, at its core, this deal is a calculation by TPLF to try to create a two-front conflict for the government. There has been the fighting in the north and in Tigray, and now if it can create a second zone of conflict in the south with the Oromo Liberation Army, it spreads the government out and reduces the military pressure the TPLF faces in the north. Now, it's significant too because it shows that the TPLF is willing and choosing to drive a wedge between Ethiopia's two largest population groups, the Amhara and the Oromo, which represent over 60% of the population. Effectively, it's undercutting one of the key points of progress under Prime Minister Abiy over the last 2 years. These two major groups have historically been rivals. And so it definitely is a way of introducing and trying to leverage ethnic politics to the benefit of the Tigrayans, which represents just 7% of the population. I think the TPLF is calculating that it wants to exploit the regional and ethnic fragility of the country so that it can advance its interest. And so I think this is significant because it is effectively signaling that the TPLF is not committed to a unified national Ethiopia. Rather, it's trying to carve out a zone of autonomy by which it will be able to operate. I think it probably also signifies that the TPLF doesn't have the popularity where it could actually rule like it did with the 30 years of autocratic governance that it led. So by forging this deal with the Oromo Liberation Army, I think it's choosing a fragmentation strategy as a way of leveling the playing field and giving itself more leverage.
Some analysts say it sounds more like a counter-strategy against the new National Front that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed forged to isolate the TPLF, and that OLA may not be as strong military as the TPLF, but the size of ethnicity gives weight to TPLF to accept that alliance. Would the announced pact carry more political than military significance?
I don't think it's likely. You know, this is a military alliance. The Oromo Liberation Army is a military unit. It's a breakaway from the Oromo Liberation Front. And it was created just 2 years ago when the OLA was unwilling to sign on to the peace agreement brokered under Abiy to end, you know, 45 years of Oromo resistance to federal authority. You know, it's been a long simmering point of tension. So this very much seems like a military maneuver to, again, create a two-front war and spread out the government. Recall that, you know, Ethiopia just had elections a couple of months ago. In those elections, the Oromo Liberation Army refused to participate. So it's clear that the OLA is not acting as a political figure. It has been and seems to continue to be pursuing a military path. And I think that's the role that TPLF is trying to exploit. I think it's also important to recognize that the Oromo Liberation Army represents just a small minority of Oromos. There are other political parties that represent the Oromo region, including the Oromo Democratic Party, of which Prime Minister Abiy was the leader, or they formed this national coalition. So it's a splinter group, and it by no means represents, you know, all of Oromia.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. The COVID-19 pandemic has heightened problems of conflict, terrorism, and scarce resources in Central Africa, plunging millions of people deeper into poverty. Heads of state from CIMAC, a six-nation grouping, called yesterday for solidarity to improve living conditions in the region. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
During a virtual Heads of State Summit Tuesday, the Central African leaders said the advent of COVID-19 forced the closure of many businesses and caused millions of workers to lose their jobs. Cameroon's President Paul Biya is chairman of the CEMAC Heads of State Conference. He says it is regrettable that many people are reluctant to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Biya says it is not possible for CEMAC to attain herd immunity when fewer than 5% of its close to 60 million people have agreed to be vaccinated against COVID-19. He says CEMAC member states should make sure all their people are vaccinated against COVID-19 so that the economic bloc can get to the crucial point of revamping its economy to fight against hardship. Christophe Mbele is an economist at the University of Yaounde. He says the COVID-19 crisis increased unemployment by between 60% and 70% across CEMAC countries. Not even pharmaceutical companies were immune to the effects of the pandemic. Mbele says local companies underproduced 5% of medicines needed by Central African countries last year. He says in 2020, CEMAC countries invested more than $269 million to import drugs from Europe and America. Mbele says if not for COVID-19, he is sure the $269 million would have been invested in home industries to create jobs and improve the well-being of suffering civilians. The six nations of CEMAC are dealing with multiple crises within their borders in addition to COVID-19. Cameroon and Chad are fighting Boko Haram terrorism on their common borders with Nigeria. Cameroon is fighting armed separatists in its English-speaking western regions. The UN also says the rebels have continued to challenge authorities in the Central African Republic with unending clashes since 2014. The region is also dealing with the effects of climate change. This week, CEMAC said several thousand people fled intercommunal violence sparked by conflicts over water from the Logone River that separates Cameroon from Chad. The Lake Chad Basin Commission says the lake's water resources have diminished by 70% within the past 50 years, and several million people in the area lack water and food. Kristalina Georgieva, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, issued a statement Tuesday after her virtual participation in the CEMAC summit from Washington. She said in 2020, COVID-19 combined with an ensuing decline in oil prices and security issues had led to a deep recession and imposed a heavy toll on CEMAC member states. She said the country's fiscal positions were weakened and external reserves depleted. Georgieva said CEMAC must accelerate the vaccination campaign to ensure a sustainable economic recovery. CEMAC anticipated a 2.8% economic growth rate in 2021. In April, though, the Bank of Central African States, which serves as the central bank for CEMAC countries, cut the anticipated growth rate to 1%, saying COVID-19 was slowing the economy. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde, Cameroon.
World Health Organization officials warn that decisions by rich countries to provide COVID-19 booster shots to their vaccinated populations will set back efforts to contain the spread of this deadly disease in Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United States, France, and Germany are among a growing number of wealthy countries planning to offer COVID-19 booster shots to their populations. This at a time when the world's poorer nations are struggling to get even one jab of these life-saving vaccines into their people's arms. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, warns that moves by some countries to introduce booster shots threaten Africa's ability to extricate itself from this crushing disease. She says richer countries that are hoarding vaccines are making a mockery of vaccine equity.
High-income countries have already, on average, administered more than 103 doses per 100 people, whereas in Africa, that number stands at 6. Failure to vaccinate the most at-risk groups in all countries will result in needless deaths. It will also contribute to conditions where the virus will very likely mutate further and could ultimately delay the global recovery from this pandemic.
WHO reports there are more than 7.3 million cases of coronavirus infections on the African continent, including 184,000 deaths. The UN Health Agency is calling for a two-month moratorium on booster shots so countries can beef up their vaccine supplies. Moeti says some progress is being made in this regard. She notes the COVAX facility has delivered nearly 10 million vaccine doses to Africa so far this month. That, she says, is 9 times what was delivered in the same period in July.
Vaccine coverage, unfortunately, remains low, with only 2% of Africans being fully vaccinated against COVID-19. We are hopeful that COVAX shipments will keep ramping up to reach 20% of Africa's population by the end of this year. And coupled with deliveries from the African Union and bilateral deals, WHO's hope for target of vaccinating 30% of people by the end of the year is still within our reach.
West Africa has recorded the highest number of COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic began. WHO reports a 193% increase in fatalities over the past 4 weeks. This is happening at a time when several West African countries are grappling with outbreaks of other diseases, including cholera, Ebola, and Marburg virus disease. Moeti says fighting multiple outbreaks is a complex challenge. She notes that West Africa health systems are more fragile than those in other sub-regions. She says they are under great strain due to the surge of COVID-19 cases. She's appealing for major investments by governments and donors to ensure outbreaks are continuously prevented, detected, and quickly contained. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Saturday, August 21st, is the International Day of Remembrance and Tribute to the Victims of Terrorism, a day that is unfortunately relevant in Burkina Faso, which is engaged in fighting Islamist militants. One Burkinabe non-profit, Gopaga, is helping widows and orphans grappling with the loss of husbands and fathers to rebuild their lives. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
Some 1.3 million people have been displaced in Burkina Faso's conflict since it began in 2015, and more than 6,000 killed, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Burkinabe military personnel are among the dead, killed fighting terror groups linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Loretta Ilbudo is the widow of a soldier killed in that fight.
Donc, c'était le 24 décembre.
She says it was on December 24, 2019. She and her family were preparing for Christmas. Her husband's uncles arrived in the morning, but she wasn't informed of his death until that evening. She said she suspected something, but wasn't told anything to begin with. Her husband died during a terrorist attack on the town of Arbinda. The couple had a daughter who was just a few months old at the time. Her husband was a nice person, she says, a bit shy and very serious about his work. He spent a lot of time with his family. They used to go on outings on his days off. A non-profit called Gopaga is helping widows like Ilbudu. Its pilot project, launched in February, provides them with support so they can make a living. Fadima Kambu is the founder of Gopaga.
Ce programme apprend aux femmes à pêcher.
She says the program is about teaching the women to fish, not giving them the fish. It's about empowering themselves and their children afterwards. The aim is for Burkina Faso to have a system of care that supports what the state already provides for these widows, Kambu says. Terrorism victims like Ubudo face complex issues, says Finyila Nialowain, United Nations Special Rapporteur for Protecting the Human Rights of Terrorism Victims.
So we get a lot of good wishes on victims of terrorism, and we get a lot of expressions of great sorrow for their sorrow. But in many ways, and I think we'll speak directly about widows, the reality is that victims of terrorism, particularly women who've been victims, need concrete and practical supports.
Today, Ubudo is an intern at an insurance company. She hopes to be fully employed so she can support her daughter. Now, she says she feels ready to move forward, and she says she wishes other women had this chance. Beginning in September, GOPAGA plans to roll out its program to support all military widows in the country. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
Dozens were killed as Islamist militants raided a civilian convoy that military police were escorting on a road between Gorgoji and Aribinda in one of Burkina Faso's most volatile zones. A government statement says 13 civilians and 14 military police were killed. On the militant side, the statement says 58 were killed in ensuing clashes with security forces. Reuters reports that President Roch Kabore has ordered 3 days of national mourning. This is the latest in a spate of attacks across West Africa's Sahel region this month. Burkina Faso, a poor country in the arid sub-Sahara region, has since 2015 been battling increasingly frequent and deadly attacks by jihadist groups affiliated with the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. COVID-19 cases have been dropping in Zimbabwe after a new wave in June sparked another lockdown with schools closed and businesses operating with limited hours. Now, many are hoping the current spike may be ending, paving the way for easing the restrictions. Reporter Kuzai Zadawashi has the details.
On Monday, Zimbabwe had 444 new COVID-19 cases, a drop of more than 80% from the peak of the current wave in July. Dr. Tinashe Gede is a physician.
It's been on a downward spiral for a few weeks now. The rate of decline is a bit lower than we saw in the second wave, but it's certainly on a downward trend. All the indications are that perhaps we're kind of getting out of the current wave.
Farai Mutambanengwe is the chief executive officer of Small to Medium Enterprises, or SME, Association of Zimbabwe.
That's a welcome development that the cases are now declining. It probably points to us having got over the worst of it. Even measures like the vaccination program looks like that's yielding results. We are also taking greater precautions.
Kede warns against complacency, as the current cases are enough to start another wave if people become reckless. Mutambanengwe pins hope on this downward trend.
So I think positive for business, because if we can all get the cases back to a manageable level, it means that the current lockdown can be relaxed. People can work more hours, because there has definitely been an impact when you look at the level of business in terms of the reduced working hours.
Government gave churches the green light to reopen for vaccinated congregants only. This is a move that many say is meant to encourage people to get shots and hint that the lockdown may be winding down. The government has also told schools to prepare to open. Although Mutambanengwe is grateful for the current partial lockdown, he hopes when the announcement for schools to reopen is given, it comes along with the relaxation of the general lockdown. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunavashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.